did the all of the work on the original PA-4, which was succeeded the receivership law. So, yeah, I was there. And you know, this is...
And this was after Public Act 4 was pretty resoundingly blown out of the water referendum.
Right. Yeah.
And Michigan voters shot that down by I think, what 3-2,
something like that.
Maybe
it was a big defeat.
And then the legislature went ahead and made a new version of it on steroids, and then added that new little voter-proof appropriations gimmick. What is the mechanism now to shoot 436 down, because it is in fact voter-proof?
Well, any law you can pass, that you can change or repeal.
Right.
You know?
Right. And the mechanism is through the legislature, and unless you have an enlightened legislature that understands that, you know, we've gone too far on this thing.
Or a sufficiently embarrassed legislature, which may be the case right now.
Maybe.
Flint Water and Detroit schools.
Maybe. I mean, you know, there is a need for... a mechanism for state intervention. There's no doubt about that. I mean, you know, I wouldn't dare say that, you know, you just let communities just...
Well, what's wrong with the bankruptcy option?
That is... Can we have that as a full discussion with experts and the like? Because, you know, there are all kinds of potential consequences that aren't there with
receiver, bondholders, a lot of things like that. Yeah.
We have to take a short break for station ID and WKUF News. We'll be back in just a few minutes with the second half of Armchair Politics.
Tom Sumner Program. Old-fashioned radio for a new generation.
Hi, I'm U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow, and I'm listening to the Tom Sumner Show.
Catch Tom and Andrea weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on WKUF LP Flint 94.3 FM.
The Tom Sumner Program. Old-fashioned radio for a new generation.
With WKUF News, I'm David Jackson for Wednesday, April 13th, 2016. Governor Snyder announced yesterday a shakeup in his executive staff. Emily Lawler on MLive.com reports that Snyder said that the changes in his staff are being made to improve the culture of state government and to ensure that people are put first across all departments. Snyder added that the people he is appointing to these new roles understand that Michigan faces many challenges right now, but that this state does not shy away from problems, and that his administration intends to tackle those problems head-on to make things better for everyone. Changes to his staff include new Chief Legal Counsel Elizabeth Clement, new Cabinet Director Mike Zimmer, and new Deputy Chief of Staff Beth Emmett. In total, Governor Snyder is replacing 6 people on his staff. The culture at the DEQ that allegedly failed in the lead-up to the Flint water crisis is under the legislative microscope. Emily Lawler on MLive.com reports that State Senator Jim Stamos of Midland, chairman of the Committee on the Flint Water Crisis, is investigating a culture that allegedly delays and ignores requests for information. Co-chairman Chris Kolb of Ann Arbor says that DEQ employees apparently have lost sight of their primary mission of protecting public health and the environment. Governor Snyder has blamed state employees for the water crisis and has stated that he is committed to a cultural change within the state government to prevent such a failure in the future. But some legislators questioned if the governor was responsible for the current culture that allowed the DEQ to ignore citizen complaints and scientific evidence. Representative Jeff Irwin of Ann Arbor pointed to initiatives like the Office of Regulatory Reinvention, which focused on eliminating regulations which, according to Irwin, came directly from the governor's office and is responsible for making regulatory bodies like the DEQ less robust. The Office of Regulatory Reinvention, created in April 2011 by Governor Snyder, was designed to increase the effectiveness of Michigan's government and, according to their website, has rescinded over 2,000 obsolete and burdensome rules. The committee is holding a series of hearings starting to April 25th to review the mistakes that led to the Flint water crisis and potentially recommend legislation to prevent a similar crisis in the future. Virginia Tech professor Mark Edwards and his team released test results yesterday showing that Flint water is still exceeding the federal action level for lead. Edwards was one of the scientists who originally brought to light the problems with Flint water and was invited to testify in Congress several weeks ago as an expert. Gary Ridley of the Flint Journal reports that the test results do show that lead and iron levels are lowering in Flint compared to August 2015. However, Edwards still says that residents have to continue using bottled water and filters until further notice. Researchers said test homes were selected at random, rather than using at least 50% of test sites as is required by the EPA. Using this method, the Virginia Tech study could be lower than what could be collected through approved EPA methods, and even if residents are sure that they have no lead plumbing, all homes in Flint are considered at risk for elevated lead levels. Edwards noted that the city's water supply is safe for bathing, and residents using it for such a purpose are at no more risk than water customers in any other city throughout the country. However, Edwards warned that testing in the 48504 zip code in Flint's northwest side is still continuing to experience steady lead concentrations. Sirens statewide and emergency broadcasts will be heard today at 1:30 for tornado emergency testing. Clark Hughes on MLive.com reports that the Michigan State Police has scheduled a statewide tornado drill. Participation is voluntary, however, State of Michigan buildings are expected to participate. Lieutenant Richard Martin of the State Police Division of Emergency Management and Homeland Security says that he hopes that this drill will begin a broader discussion about emergency preparedness and get people to consider what they would do if a tornado was imminent in their area. State police note that while tornadoes happen any time of the year, they are most common in late spring and early summer. And finally, federal authorities have announced that they are reviewing the possibility of loosening the classification of marijuana. ABC News reports that marijuana is currently classified as a Schedule 1, meaning it is listed along with and considered to be as dangerous as heroin and LSD. The DEA announced last week that it is reviewing the possibility of reclassifying it as a Schedule 2 drug, which would put it in the same category as Ritalin, Adderall, and oxycodone. Medical experts are welcoming the review, saying it could ease restrictions for researchers so that they can better understand which compounds in the plant could be used to help patients. For WKUF News, I'm David Jackson.
You're listening to WKUFLP Flint Community Radio, your listener-supported station. Broadcasting at 94.3 megahertz from the campus of Kettering University. The views and opinions expressed in some of our programming are not necessarily those of Kettering University or of WKUFLP Flint. If you have any questions or comments concerning our programming, you may contact us at wkuf@kettering.edu or call us at 1-800-955-4464, extension 9665.
The Tom Sumner Program. Old-fashioned radio for a new generation.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Tom. You know that.
Yay, Tom! I love it in Flint!
You're very astute, Tom.
Tom, easy question.
I'll debate Andy Dillon on your show.
Well, that's a very good question.
Hello, darling. This is Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, with Tom Sumner.
I'm all right, Tom. How are you?
Hey, lucky day, Mr. Sumner.
Ciao, Tom. How are you today?
That's a good question.
Hi, this is actor, comedian Jonah Pody, and you're listening to the Tom Snyder, Tom Smothers. I'm sorry, what's his name? Oh, Sumner. The Tom Sumner Program.
Good morning, Tom. How are you doing?
Hey, at least I got the Tom part right.
Catch Tom and Andrea weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on WKUFLP Flint, 94.3 FM.
The Tom Sumner Program. Old-fashioned radio for a new generation.
Hey, Hey, welcome back, everybody. This is Armchair Politics Part 2 on the Tom Sumner Program here on WKUF LP Flint 94.3 FM. Our panel of political pundits this week, Paul Rozicki on the left, Paige Brusseau on the right, and our very special guest, Woodrow Stanley. And we have someone, before the news break at the top of the hour, we sparked a caller with our talk about Public Act 436 who is standing by and wants to raise what I think is an interesting part of this conversation before we move on to some of the state headlines. Anyway. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Where's your caller?
Scared him away.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom, and good morning, gentlemen. Tom, I just heard one of the remarks made that we should have an enlightened legislature, and there's no doubt about it. That's exactly what we need. It would be very helpful, especially in this political climate that we see happening today. But what about an enlightened electorate? And I'd like to speak to Mayor Stanley. Mayor Stanley, it starts at home. It's always started at home on these issues, at least for me, as I look at the situation in Flint or any city that's having these problems, whether it's water, economics, you name it. It begins with your leadership that the people put in place at home. Mayor Stanley, when I'm talking about an enlightened electorate, can anybody argue that it was a good idea for the people of the city of Flint to vote in Mayor Don Williamson? Knowing what we know now, how can anybody argue that that was an enlightened decision collectively by the voters of the city of Flint? Likewise, it could be argued, in my opinion, was it a good idea for the people of the city of Detroit, as a so-called enlightened electorate, to elect not once but twice Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick? And I think that what we know about Mayor Kilpatrick now, I think that he probably, during those years that led up to Detroit's bankruptcy, contributed in some way, shape, or fashion to the problems that actually led to Detroit's bankruptcy. I could be wrong. I could be right. My point is this, sir. We can talk about an enlightened legislature, and that is needed. We want people in office that know what they're doing. I hope, for the sake of the people of the city of Flint, with the election of Mayor Weaver and the city council such as it is, that will occur. That Mayor Weaver, once Flint gets through this water crisis, will find the leadership to go into the 21st century and economically make Flint a comeback city. It won't happen with the auto industry. But I'm just hoping, for the sake of the people of the city of Flint, that the choice that they have made for mayor and city council, that's going to provide the leadership that this city needs to move forward. That was my comment on an enlightened electorate. People, especially in this day and age, and you're talking to a person who considers himself to be engaged in the political arena, and I myself I'm having to rethink an awful lot of positions that I've taken, especially during this political season. I try to stay engaged, and I'm like so many people in the world of politics, gentlemen, that sometimes when emotion gets the better of you, it causes you to do and think and support some issues that you wouldn't if emotion wasn't a factor into the process. So I myself am rethinking some of these political stances that I've taken, and we'll see what happens in November. But all I'm saying is this: we need an enlightened electorate, and I think.
Okay, Bob. Bob, I'm gonna stop you there because I want to make sure that the guys have a chance to jump in and pick up this important thing that you bring to the table. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the call.
Sorry for the speech, Tom.
It's all right.
That's great. I'm going to add one quick one. There's a famous quote from Winston Churchill: "The best argument against democracy is a 10-minute conversation with the average voter." I'll let it go from there.
I don't disagree with the enlightened electorate point that Bob made. I do disagree, and I'm not sure if I understood correctly him saying that the election of Don Williamson was an act of enlightenment on the part of the citizens of Flint. I certainly would disagree with that. But I just make one final point that
or the recall of Woodrow Stanley.
I can say that.
Was a very light in a flint to recall Woodrow Stanley.
But here's one thing that I think that folks, a lot of folks have swallowed, is that Kwame Kilpatrick caused the financial and economic calamity in Detroit. Absolutely not. There were folks who said Woodrow Stanley is the reason that General Motors left Flint. I wasn't even in middle school when General Motors started to pull out.
That was a 30-year process.
There are folks who've done scholarly forensic examination. So Kwame Kilpatrick, as for all of his warts and sins and transgressions, Kwame Kilpatrick did not cause the economic decline and collapse of Detroit. He did. I mean, you know, there's no.
Well, it did begin 30 years, 40 years ago.
Absolutely not.
Years,
now, yeah. did he do a lot of crazy, dumb stuff that put the city and the state in a bad light? Absolutely. But any objective examination would have to say, hey, look, the guy did some stuff that got him in a position that he has to own up to. Mm-hmm. And he's doing that right now. But let's not, because what it does is it gets to a point about who can govern and who shouldn't govern. And you tie that back to emergency manager laws that the majority of people of color in the state of Michigan are living under some form of emergency management.
Either in their school district or their municipality.
Absolutely.
And you know, mm-hmm. that. And one of the questions that I've had about PA 436 in particular since it was enacted, I don't see any success stories.
Well, that's the difficulty.
I mean, look, Benton Harbor, are they putting that forward as an emergency manager success story? Pontiac, are they putting that forward as an emergency manager success story? Certainly not Detroit Public Schools. Certainly not the city of Flint. You know, Detroit had an emergency manager whose job seems to have solely been to manage their smooth transition into and out of bankruptcy. He was a bankruptcy lawyer, in fact.
Right. Yeah.
But Tom,
are there any victories?
They're not because what we expect can't be achieved. What people expect. The emergency manager comes in and says, you know, I'm going to balance the books, and then we sort of morph over into making some political decisions, which we shouldn't get involved with. But it's not a sustainable governance model, because the antidote to poverty, crime, and all of the rest is a job. It's economic activity. And an emergency manager is not going to come in and bring in factories and so forth. So at best, it is a temporary way of stopping the financial hemorrhaging, at best. The rest of it, we've got to grapple with in terms of how do we
but here's have the thing
communities
that's frustrating.
That can create sustainable economic activities in places like Flint, Detroit, Philadelphia.
Well, emergency managers, they're not magicians. As you say, when you lose 100,000 people of your population and their paychecks and 80,000 GM jobs,
emergency
manager can undo that with a wave of one.
But here's the thing, and Flint has become sort of ground zero, even before the water crisis, about emergency managers, because we've been through the process twice in this most recent time with multiple managers. And a $20 million deficit, whether it's under the administration of Woodrow Stanley or under the administration of Don Williamson and then Dane Walling, now Karen Weaver has announced a budget that projects a $35 million deficit. Of course, we've got water problems to factor in. But a deficit is a deficit is a deficit. And unless and this is something that the caller, Bob, has brought up many times before on the show, unless the focus is about creating jobs or figuring out some way to attract businesses that will create jobs,
right,
there's still going to be that deficit because the revenue stream mm-hmm. is gone.
It
doesn't matter how much power you get. This is when it's fun to see, you know, people talking about they're chasing power. What power? They have power to end that deficit. They can manipulate the numbers. Right. They can raid the water fund. They can do what they want to do. And they can come out with a budget for the next year, maybe 2 years, that looks balanced. It's a balanced budget. But that deficit did not go away. That's what every mayor since the recall of Woodrow Stanley has learned.
And Tom, connect this quickly to the charter process that Flint and I know Paul's been in attendance and so have I, and I think Paige has as well. So connect that quickly to the charter review process. So there are folks who believe that if you change the governance model in the city of Flint, you will automatically stabilize the community. And now here's a guy that has far more expertise. I don't mean to put that word on you, Paul, but certainly has far more experience in looking at just the scholarly examination of political dynamics and so forth. But Paul, do you know of any significant scholarly evidence that says if you change the governance model, that automatically you have economic prosperity? I mean,
they did a pretty good job in 1776.
But
it's been a while.
A few more contemporary examples. So here's just some communities that come to mind that have had significant financial distress. Washington, D.C., New York City, Stockton, California, Cleveland, Birmingham, Alabama. Now, I'm not talking about any of these communities that are in Michigan, so you can call the roll in Michigan.
New Orleans.
None of them have significantly changed their governance model. So is there some scholarly...
My argument's always been, if in some ways we look at the wrong thing, does it really matter who you put on the city council or as mayor? Or does the GM board of directors matter? I mean, who made the decisions in Flint to change Flint? Was it anybody in government, again, mayor, city council, or was it the GM board of directors when they decided to close plants or open plants? I mean, that's where Flint grew to begin with. But the real decisions really weren't made in the governmental sphere at all. They were made beyond the government.
And you remember, and I, of course, I was there on the city council, and as mayor, we gave every single tax abatement that was requested. Mm-hmm. Every last one of them.
Well, so far, it appears to me at the local and state level, the tax abatement is the only tool in the governing economic toolbox.
Tom,
it's the only one I ever see used.
Actually, and on this one, I have done some research, a significant amount of research. Actually, tax abatements in the top 10 reasons that companies locate, tax abatements don't rate. And it is a myth that tax abatements move the decision needle in terms of I'm going to go. We give tax abatements because the other community give the tax abatement.
Everybody's the lowest common
denominator. If the things that the companies are looking at, quality of workforce, schools, and
labor
housing,
costs,
all of that. If those things are not in place, you can give them all the tax abatements in the world. And they're going to say, no, we're going to that community as opposed to. So there's a myth that tax abatements move the economic decision-making needle in terms of job location. Not true. It isn't. But the politicians, we get involved in it because
everybody else does.
Yeah, because we have to.
Would it ever be wise?
But that's my point, Woodrow. It seems that that's the only tool in the economic development toolbox. There has to be
something
else.
The perception is.
There has to be something else. Because, like, for example, right now in the city of Flint, if you try to do economic development for the city of Flint, I would not want to have that job. I would not want to be traveling to, you know, conventions and meetings around the country and trying to pitch Flint with its history of high violent crime and now don't drink the water. I mean, it has third world status in the world of attracting economic development. And that's going to be a tremendous challenge going forward. Tax abatements are not going to have any impact on that. But it does move me, and I want to get to at least one more point before we have to
Well, if I could say something about this.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Is that in Lansing, not just public officials, but bureaucrats that go out and try to find businesses to relocate and startups to come, they go to Washtenaw County, they go to Livingston County, they go to Kent County, they don't come to Genesee County. And the reason is that because they look at these places, they look great on brochures. There's lots of people there that have great high-paying jobs and low infrastructure costs, I guess you could say. We need advocates in Lansing to advocate for Genesee County and the city of Flint and Pontiac and Detroit.
Yeah, that's true.
I agree.
Well, at least the feds have stepped up with a boost of $55 million to tear down blighted structures in Detroit and Flint. The U.S. Department of Treasury announced yesterday that they were awarding an additional $74.5 million in hardest-hit funds to Michigan to help stabilize the housing market in the state. Detroit will get $41.9 million, and Flint gets $13.9 million, and the remaining $18.6 million will go to help homeowners struggling under the weight of expensive or underwater mortgages, no pun intended. That doesn't mean Flint mortgage. How important is blight elimination in stabilizing troubled cities like Flint and Detroit?
That's important.
It's a start.
It is. So you got to take out the old stuff, but the other part, the other side of that coin is, if you take out all of the old burned out stuff, what about building some new stuff? What about rehabbing some of the stuff that's that actually can be rehabbed? Because if you take out all of this housing, you also are moving your population base.
You
want to attract folks,
the population base is already moved.
There are folks who are still here, and there are folks who would live in the city. I'm the guy who built the first new housing development in the city in 35 years. And guess who the major opposition was? The Realtor Association.
Oh, yeah, I suppose, yeah.
And you know why? Because they wanted most of the houses to be built in suburbia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They would be the beneficiary of new housing because they would sell them.
Yeah. I thought they were just still after you, after your days on the city council.
No. I think the other side of that coin is I'm glad to hear about the new blight elimination dollars, but we have to create new housing
to bring people in. I recall seeing one photograph that the Detroit News or Free Press ran, a full page thing, a big picture of Detroit showing all this green space. I mean, it looked like you were somewhere in the middle of Upper Michigan someplace.
Right.
It was the downtown Detroit, but all these empty lots with nothing.
The burned and abandoned houses need to be taken down because we can talk about building new houses and that might give us a spot to build, but I have a house behind me, right behind my fence, that has been burnt down since 2013. Who knows when that's going to be taken down? That's not helping my property values. It's not helping everybody else. It's not helping the kids in the neighborhood.
Oh, I remember before Dave Barber passed away, he was in Flint visiting friends, and he still had some. And but he drove over on the east side of Flint, and he was just, you know, I think it broke his heart a little bit, you know, because it looks like post-World War II, war-torn Europe over there. And there are that's not the only neighborhood. This happened to be one that comes to mind that, you know, it has suffered from vacant housing that have been stripped and graffitied and damaged, ones that have been burned out.
I got a similar story. You know Bill Johnson, who was mayor of Rochester and taught at Mott for a while? Bill gets back here every now and then and was driving around Flint, and he, too, was just shocked.
Right.
And he hadn't been gone that long about how much things had changed in his neighborhoods.
Land reuse is a topic, and it's a hot-button topic, but it's a topic that has to be engaged right now because the window to discuss it is now. It's not 5 years from now. It's not a year from now. When you're talking about removing pipes and so forth, you have to talk about what size city are we talking about.
Is it possible to get, the people who've been in a house for two or three generations, on a block, and they end up being the last of either one house or two or three houses, to say, there's vacant property on the other side of town. Can we move you to this other place so that we can eliminate this block from the infrastructure? Can that be done?
I think it can be done.
And is Karen Weaver?
It's been done.
Has Karen
Wrong
Weaver,
way, but it's been done.
has Karen Weaver got the political capital right now to advocate for that?
Well,
and get people open to that idea, because people hate to leave their house. They don't
absolutely.
They don't care how bad the burned out house is.
Right. It's my neighborhood, and it has all of the memories.
I grew up here. My parents lived here. Whatever.
Remember this: we have a master plan that's in place, so there is a template to an objective. Now, I'm not saying that the master plan doesn't have to be tweaked, and in some cases, maybe significant parts of it changed. But we do have a template that's in place. I would recommend that we use that as a reference point. I think that she has to engage this idea, because the window on this, and it is an emotional issue. I don't care if it's only one house, as you said, on that block. I what I see, and I'm speaking in the voice of that person that's on that block, what I see is my memories. Mm-hmm. Every time I turn down that block, I see a block with houses and kids and so forth. And so leaving that, I'm not a psychologist, but I know enough about this to know, because, again, I was raised in a community that was removed as a part of urban renewal, the old St. John Street neighborhood, and then mm-hmm. later the Oak Park neighborhood. Both of those were removed because of urban renewal. And so I know that there is, when you move people, it's just not the physical movement. There's a psychological displacement that takes place there. So, yes, we have to engage that. And I think we can do, I think we know a lot more now than we knew in the 60s and the 70s when that was done across this country. And then we can use that and engage folks out there that have experience in it.
And then you're going to see the emotional news story coming out of the person crying as they leave their home.
If it's done voluntarily, it's not an issue. In fact, I encourage it. The money we waste sending money to water to neighborhoods that aren't used could be better spent to buy these properties. But if it's done through, I don't care what the Supreme Court says, taking property from a landowner for a use that is not eminent domain, mm-hmm. such as highways or pipelines or something like that, that is unconstitutional. I don't care what the Supreme Court says. So if we go into these neighborhoods and just say, we're giving you the land value of this house, and you have to move, you have 90 days to move, that, I'd be, mm-hmm. I find that abhorrant. People.
Wouldn't it be possible through some kind of creating manipulation of properties through the land bank to swap property for property? I mean, it seems like there's a path least resistance there.
Right. But, and Tom, interesting that you mentioned this, and I'll just say this real quick. Someone just mentioned last week at a meeting, and they were talking specifically about a development that I actually initiated, and that's Smith Village.
Smith Village. Mm-hmm.
And right now it's stalled. And they said, why not? We were talking about land reuse. And so they said, why not take some of the folks who are in communities where there's one or two, and swap a house and say, hey, look, let's fill this place up. And so, I think that there are some enlightened ways. We know a lot more about how to do this than we did when we did it in mass in the 60s and the 70s. So, you just pointed out, it's amazing how many problems that we solve when we solve.
I know.
Jeez, man.
And something I didn't think I'd ever see was former mayor and Representative Woodrow Stanley saying something that sounded very much like things I've heard Dane Walling say.
That, you know, he started talking about the strategic plan. I thought, this, wait a minute, which former mayor do I have here?
Tom, remember this. I have to claim that Dane actually is a protege. Dane was on my mayor youth cabinet. We've had a personal relationship for all of his from the time he was in high school to now, and I still talk to him. So. You know, I maybe what you were hearing was not so much me talking as him, as him, because the things that in terms of, you know, having a master plan and the like, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes sense. So,
no, it does. And I think I don't always weigh in on some of the things that we talk about. I try and get the people better equipped to talk about these things to comment than myself. But the on the issue of I completely lost my train of thought.
Well, let's tell you what.
No. It was back. It was back before the. Oh no, it was about the charter revision.
Oh right.
There is this sense that as the city shrinks, should we look at, because we haven't in a while, the idea of making the city smaller? And I think that's. You know, do we need 9 council people, or could we do it with 7? Or, you know, that it deserved a revisit after 50 years, and it probably did.
Right.
I don't think any. And most interestingly enough, most of the work going on by that commission is just refining the existing charter. They're very much sticking to the same sort of things that we saw in the charter. I don't think we're going to see big radical changes come out of that group. Now, I think they're just getting into the thing about city council. That'll be interesting to see if they, you know, if they do
there's
support it.
There's a meeting coming up in a week or so, I think,
yeah,
for that group.
Yeah, very soon there's going to be an open meeting to talk about, you know, what kind of council do you see. But they've already decided more or less to stick with a strong form of
mayor. Well, my argument has always been is that good people can make any system work and bad people can screw up any system. So the nuts and bolts of whether you have city manager, strong mayor, this or that, I mean, those are interesting, but there are no magic silver bullet to fix any problems.
Right. We've got to get a break in here before we do our last segment of the Armchair Politics, but we'll be right back with more right after this.
The Tom Sumner Program. Old-fashioned radio for a new generation.
Hi, this is Deb Cherry, Genesee County Treasurer, and you're listening to the Tom Sumner Radio Show.
Catch Tom and Andrea weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on WKUFLP Flint 94.3 FM.
The Tom Sumner Program. Old-fashioned radio for a new generation.
Good morning, Flint and Genesee County. According to the National Weather Service at 8:37, we're looking at mostly cloudy skies today, high near 50, and tonight mostly cloudy skies. Then as we get closer to breakfast, it'll become mostly clear with a low around 30. And Thursday, looking real good, sunny with a high near 57. And gusty as well, maybe about up to 20 miles an hour. Currently, under mostly cloudy skies, it's warmed up to 38 degrees. Stay tuned and thanks for listening.
Discoveries. They happen when we least expect them, in places we thought we knew. And discoveries have a way of teaching us a little more about ourselves along the way. Welcome to Flint and Genesee County, where up north meets down south. Home to Michigan's largest county park system and a vibrant culture. A place filled with discoveries we've yet to make, throughout acres of beautiful lakes, wetlands, and woods, and in the diverse city beyond. Where the uplifting melodies of gospel choirs fill the air, where the work of renowned artists color the galleries and museums, where the fresh fruits and vegetables at the downtown farmers market awaken our senses, and where the cultural center and planetarium broaden our view of the world. Let's spend a few days enjoying the wonders of Flint and Genesee County, where the joy of discovery is pure Michigan. Your trip begins at Michigan.org.
Support for WKUF comes from Good Beans Cafe, 328 North Grand Traverse. Telephone number 237-GOOD. Constantly supporting community, culture, and the arts. Good Beans Cafe.
You thought you had every Elvis record made, but wait, Elvis sings again. This time, from heaven. That's right, Elvis from heaven. Yes, hear Elvis from Graceland in the sky. Soul-stirring versions of epic proportions. You'll hear Elvis crooning, Pearly Gate Rock. All dug up. Lying in the chapel, and 11 others. This record also includes a special Elvis message.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elvis Presley.
Order before midnight tonight and receive this Elvis Presley commemorative casket keychain. Open it up. Yes, the king inside. A must for any Elvis fan. Order yours today.
To order your Elvis from Heaven, send $9.95 in check or money order to Elvis from Heaven, P.O. Box 714, Clio, Michigan, 44487. Or save COD charges and phone 555-5554. Use MasterCharge or Visa. Canadian residents add $3.
Hi, I'm Xavier B. Please join me Saturday nights from 6 until 9 for the Retro Mix, where I play music from back in the day. Each week, I'll feature an artist, genre, or era. So if you want to kick it old school, check out the Retro Mix right here on WKUFLP Flint, 94.3 FM.
Sunrise Coast Cigar Lounge is a proud sponsor of WKUFLP Flint, 94.3 FM. Sunrise Coast Tobacco is located at 4225 Miller Road, Flint, Michigan. Telephone number 810-720-5554.
Meet Ellen Sherman, Cleveland housewife and mother.
Hi, I'm a nuclear physicist and commissioner of consumer affairs. In my spare time, I do needlepoint, read, sculpt, take riding lessons, and brush up on my knowledge of current events. Thursday's my day at the daycare center, and then there's my work with the deaf. But I still have time left over to do all my own baking and practice my backhand, even though I'm on call 24 hours a day as a legal aid.
How does Ellen Sherman do it all? Right now, she's smart. She takes Speed, the tiny blue diet pill you don't have to be overweight to need.
And then I collect these paper bags, and I have them right here, all folded and everything, in case anyone needs a paper bag, I have
them. Yes,
one.
Speed.
Because I fold them neatly, you know, I don't fold them just any old way.
Why not ask your family doctor for a prescription today? And when that runs out, you can ask your neighbor's doctor, and your mother's doctor, and your college roommate's doctor, and your best friend from high school's doctor, and your babysitter.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Armchair Politics on the Tom Sumner Program on WKUFLP Flint, 94.3 FM. We have Paul Rosicki on the left, Paige Brusseau on the right, and our special guest this week, Woodrow Stanley, joining us here at the roundtable for Armchair Politics. Running a little bit behind, I wanted to get to several other things. I'll see if we can't do kind of a lightning round here and pick up a couple of these. We talked about Virgil Smith's resignation. Mm-hmm. Now the governor has set his the special election to be concurrently with the regular election in the August primary and November general. Is the timing of this special election going to result in a flood of candidates looking to fill the open seat, causing a shift in Wayne County's House delegation?
I don't think they'll.
It's a Democratic district, right, pretty much, right. I think. Yeah.
No, but are we going to see a lot of people changing
any
seats?
Any open election. Right.
Musical chairs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because I think what the Sheldon Neely primary, I think there were 8 or 9 people.
That's right. Yeah.
So right, the
you'll
open
see a lot
seat.
Of people throwing their hands in the ring.
Open Senate seat, absolutely.
You know well.
Every House member
chased after one of those yourself.
As you know,
every House member who, well, they don't have to necessarily live in the district, but you know, if they can establish residency, they'll be there.
Yeah, it'll be a shot.
The other thing I wanted to talk about was the state GOP convention over the weekend.
Yeah, interesting convention.
It's good times.
Yeah. Now, you were there as an alternate?
I was there. Well, I got elected as an alternate for Ted Cruz for the national convention.
Okay.
Congratulations.
Now, does that mean you don't get to vote till the second ballot?
No, well, that means...
I
can only vote if the Marianne... Rinky,
you're going to stay at the Dahmer House
County,
and everything?
She is the main delegate. So if she leaves the floor for any reason or she doesn't show up, then I can move to the floor and vote. But I'm sure when they vote for the presidential nominee, she'll probably be on the floor.
But now, if she's incapacitated before then, you automatically take that spot.
Yes.
Marianne, I would advise her to get
some security.
Yeah, security.
But what... Now, there was some talk... 25 Trump delegates and 17 each for Kasich and Ted Cruz. Is that about how it shakes out?
It's pretty much that breakdown, I believe.
And how did the election for Rob Steele and who was the Kathy Burden?
Yeah, she got reelected. Rob Steele, this is his first go as committee man.
For RNC?
Michigan Republican committee man. Kathy Burden was the committee woman, because there needs to be a man and a woman. I don't know if the Democrats, I believe, might be like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Far as I know, they were large leads in the runners-up, conceded, and threw all their support to the ones who were elected. But that was the only brouhaha we had going on.
Mm-hmm. Who were the former...
Ajima.
Oh, right.
Dave Ajima.
Yeah.
Dave Ajima. And,
there is a lot of joy in the Republican Party that Dave Ajima is no longer.
And, of course, before Kathy was...
And in the legislature as well.
Yeah, but the question is, now what's he going to do? What's he going to get into?
Yeah. I served with Dave Ajima.
Now, since we met last, the Wyoming primary...
That's right. Gave
all of the votes to... To Bernie, but all of the delegates to Hillary.
That's right, yeah. We're getting, what's really interesting, this is going to be a great year. We're now getting to this inside baseball stuff where the people who carry the state don't necessarily get the delegates. And now we're getting down to where individual people are being chosen on the district level and the local level. And the real question is, are they going to stick with their candidate? It's more so for Republicans, but Democrats are facing the same kind of issue. Where these individual delegate choices are going to matter an awful lot.
You've got to know the rules.
And if you go to a second ballot...
Somebody told me, or told that to Donald Trump last night, and he didn't seem to agree with you.
he wants it to be on name recognition.
I don't need those thinking rules.
120% name recognition. But his campaign
said they're making up rules to keep him out.
The rules, particularly in Colorado, were formulated last summer. Yeah. So this isn't...
But in all seriousness, there does seem to be a lot of fire behind the Bernie smoke. And the momentum for Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side,
and
just as there seems to be,
but
you know, we're starting to see the decline of Trump.
Maybe I think so, but who knows?
New York is really going to tell us.
It'll be a big
you know,
test.
Whether
if Trump doesn't win New York, he's in big trouble. But if he does,
whether this is a trend or an anomaly, you know, we'll see if. But it looks like it's darn likely that both conventions will have a fight.
Yeah. And Tom,
I think that's great personally.
I think it's great. Fascinating, you know, but looking forward to November. So on both sides, you have the same dynamic, and that is you have quote unquote outsiders represented by Trump on the Republican side and Bernie on the Democratic side. So,
and with all his years, in office, I kind of think of him as the professional outsider.
But the same elements and dynamics are at play both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, you have this
somewhat
energy. And what do you want going into November? And so if either of those folks, I don't suspect that Bernie is going to be the nominee, and I have some doubts about whether or not Trump is going to be the nominee. But you want that energy going forward, because that propels you, that difference in terms of the base.
Without Trump, without Bernie, do you have it? Because 8 years ago, we saw the kind of insurgence that Bernie Sanders is right. bringing into the race.
Right. Right.
Oddly enough, also against right. Hillary.
Right.
But it went on into the general.
Because Obama was the nominee. It.
Exactly.
In this case, if you have either of these two who are the standard bearers for this element that aren't the nominee, what happens to that energy? Does it dissipate? Or is it folded into the efforts and the organization of the two nominees?
I think it's with both of them, it's uncharted waters.
It is.
Particularly if both of them receive the nomination, which I doubt both will. You have Bernie Sanders, who is a self-described socialist, who's never been part of the Democratic Party, even though he caucuses with them. Running for the nomination of the
Democratic Socialist.
Yeah.
And then you have Donald Trump, who has been on both sides of the political spectrum,
right.
even as late as last year.
And his kids
as late as last right. night.
Yes, right. yeah. exactly. exactly.
Oh, shoot. House Speaker Paul Ryan has said, I won't run. I won't accept my party's nomination. He has ruled himself completely out of consideration. Who do you think is going to make it out of Cleveland?
Ted Cruz.
Do you?
I do.
How you're leaning? As an observer, not necessarily as a participant,
yeah.
but
I think Cruz also. It would be great to have Don because he just he gets me engaged in watching.
Yeah,
I want to see him trip over.
But
his
I can see with Republicans winner take all.
He should just keep having press conferences. Even if he drops out.
Well, I suspect that there will be a third party.
You think?
That's a possibility too. If Trump doesn't get it, that's a possibility. Yeah.
Well, on.
Jesse Ventura is talking about running if Trump doesn't get nominated.
Just what we forgot about him.
Where's
Ross Perot? When
What happened to Rand Paul?
He has one delegate, the one in the Cleveland.
Does
so
he?
He's got one delegate.
He might be able to parlay it to the nomination. It's from Iowa.
Oh, from Iowa.
Yeah, he dropped out before New Hampshire.
That's right. But this was kind of interesting. As long as we were talking about Donald Trump, he said Monday that his children, Erica and Ivanka, feel very, very guilty that they will be unable to vote for him in New York's primary next Tuesday because they missed the state's voter registration deadline. They had a long time to register, and they were unaware of the rules, so they feel very, very guilty. They feel very guilty, but it's fine. I understand that, the real estate mogul said on Fox News, Fox and Friends. I think they have to register a year in advance. So Eric and Ivanka, I guess, won't be voting. He also said that he didn't think he was going to need their votes to win the New York primary. But that could just be Trump talk. But is this just bad staff work?
It exemplifies the lack of seriousness.
Yeah, I think
that's what I can't help thinking.
Although if you heard that there's the delegate selection process in Washington State coming up, so the Trump campaign sent out mailings and emails to residents of Washington, D.C. because they apparently didn't know there was a difference between Washington State and Washington, D.C. I just want to tell the Trump campaign there is a Baja California as well as a California, so make sure they have those addresses right as well.
Well, I love it when Republicans fight.
Is he going to get Baja to pay for his California suite?
Maybe
make it
first state. I don't know.
Hey, I had to leave a couple of things by the wayside because we're getting close to the end of the time here. But I did want to squeeze in at least one X-File. Bank robbers in southern Brazil donned a highly unusual disguise for a heist. The duo covered themselves from head to toe in aluminum foil for the early Saturday morning raid on the Banco da Brasil branch in Praia Grande. Police said they believed their improvised outfits would beat the bank's alarm system and stop it from sounding. They wanted to make sure the alarms didn't detect their presence by using the aluminum foil, according to a spokesman for the Santa Catarina's state's military police. Told to a Brazilian newspaper. Astonishingly, the robbers' plan appeared to work.
Now they tell
but
us.
As their cloaks didn't allow Harry Potter-style invisibility, the hapless pair were still captured by the bank's surveillance cameras. Security staff working at Banco de Brasil's regional headquarters in Florianopolis alerted police, and an armed response unit arrived on the scene. The duo fled empty-handed, leaving blowtorches and other implements they were using to try and crack a safe behind. On Sunday morning, they remained on the lam, reports the Daily Mirror. A third man has reportedly been arrested, accused of being the pair's lookout. Does this mean foil helmets might actually work in thwarting alien mind control and or government surveillance?
Maybe there's something to the foil head crowd. I think
this is one of the funniest things I've read in a long time. Not because they got away, but because wrapping themselves in foil apparently fooled the alarm system somehow.
Well, maybe they forgot to turn the alarm system on. They're just saying
maybe it's short-circuited or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I just picture these guys standing in front of the surveillance cameras going, "You can't see me." Meanwhile, the sirens are blowing.
Had a guy coming in my office with a foil. A hubcap wrapped in aluminum foil, complaining of getting alien signals, and he wanted.
Well, that's been the standard safeguard against police radar guns and alien transmissions. But this is the first time I've heard of it being used to thwart a bank security system. Well, good for them. good science-y types. We like that. Anyway, it wraps it up for today's edition of Armchair Politics. Thanks again to Woodrow Stanley for being our special guest.
You.
It's always fun talking politics
the foil
with you.
Story.
And as always, the Flint's premier political pundit, Paul Rozicki.
Good to be here.
And Paige Russo from the Genesee County GOP. He is their VP. This may be last time for a little while.
Probably. I got some stuff going on.
Well, we'll
need
we'll
to save some money so I can go to Cleveland. I
see what he's moving on to bigger and better things.
Maybe. I will accept the nomination. I am over 35, and I natural born citizen.
You could be. That's right. It's a possibility. Keep your options open.
I will be there.
Yeah.
I'll be a secretary and decorate the interior.
Is your wife registered to vote?
She is.
Okay.
Oh, all right. Oh, okay.
All right. Well, then you're probably
over the threshold.
You're ahead of Trump already.
On that note, we'll wrap things up. Andrea and I will be back in a moment to wrap up today's edition of the Tom Sumner Program. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
You've been listening to Armchair Politics on the Tom Sumner Program. You, too, can be part of Armchair Politics by sending your comments, questions, and suggestions to us. Find us on Facebook. Join us next week at the same time for more Armchair Politics on the Tom Sumner Program. Old-fashioned radio for a new generation.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Tom Sumner Program. Thanks again to our roundtable of political pundits for Armchair Politics. And thanks, of course, to Bob for tuning in. And to my co-host and associate producer, Andrea Sutton. Thanks for tuning in. Tomorrow, tomorrow we got a good one. The Oakland County Sheriff, who ran for governor a few years ago, Mike Bouchard, has just been recently announced Sheriff of the Year by a National Sheriff's Association. He'll be joining me by phone at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning on the Tom Sumner Program. Leon El Alamin will be by to talk about environment class. Boy, did I read that wrong, and that's my own handwriting. An expungement class. Those are two very different things, and something we're looking very forward to talking to Leon El Alamin about. Anyway, we got, and also coming up on Friday's show, We have State House Member Joe Graves will be joining us. And if at all possible, we're going to try and reschedule Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. He was supposed to be in the studio with us on Monday to take calls, came down sick and had to cancel. And we have tentatively rescheduled for Friday, folks, but we'll let you know tomorrow for sure if we get that locked in place or when we will do that. It's going to be open phone lines with Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. So by all means, have a great day, folks, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow morning at 6.
The Tom Sumner Program is a live variety show. We want to acknowledge all of our guests who play such an important role in the show and our cavalcade of cohorts from coast to coast for their regular contributions. Most of the musical accompaniment was provided by people in or from the Flint area. Many of the pre-recorded portions of the Tom Sumner program are made possible by Flint's own Steve McComb and Pencil Sketch Recording in Nashville, Tennessee. If you have comments,